You're listening to Work in Progress. I'm Ramona Schindelheim, Editor-in-Chief of Working Nation. Work in Progress explores the rapidly changing workplace through conversations with innovators, educators, and decision-makers, people with solutions to today's workforce challenges. My guest today is Michelle Weiss, entrepreneur in residence and senior advisor at Imaginable Futures, and the former chief innovation officer of the Strata Education Network's Institute for the Future of Work. Michelle spent the past decade looking at how we prepare our workforce for the shifting skills they need to find work today and tomorrow. She put all that knowledge and experience into her new book, Long Life Learning, Preparing for Jobs That Don't Even Exist Yet. Michelle, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, and welcome back to the show.
Hi, Ramona. Thanks for having me.
We've had this conversation in different ways before, and I'm really glad that you wrote a book about it so you can share it with a lot more people now. You've been looking at the shift in education and how it is transforming to coincide with how jobs are transforming and how we have to learn, because we can't just learn in college for 4 years and then start working. Tell me a little bit about the premise of the book and why you decided to write it.
Sure. This all began when I heard someone talk about how futurists and some experts on aging and longevity were forecasting that some of the first people to live to be 150 years old had already been born. And that just completely blew my mind in terms of, you know, helping me with a new mental model for the future. Because I think in general, we always have heard and have agreed with this notion of lifelong learning. But suddenly when you think about a longer work life and this idea of long life learning, it really upends all of our working assumptions about education and work. And this was also happening at the same time where we were starting to realize that the transition from education to work and retirement was just not as simple as it used to be. So suddenly, as you think about 150 years of life, you know, everything kind of just sharpens and comes into perspective, where you realize, how in the world will 2, 4, or 6 years of education actually sustain me through, you know, what could be a 60, 80, or 100-year work life? And even if you don't necessarily buy into these projections, it's still just sort of a helpful mental model even today to think through the fact that most of our workforce is actually staying in for much longer than historically we've ever seen. You know, people are going well into their 60s and 70s and having and facing way more job transitions than they ever imagined. So all of this kind of came to a head for me in that moment of kind of first hearing about some of these prognostications. And it helped me figure out how we go from just talking about lifelong learning to actually shifting our behavior and changing our behavior and creating new investment theses around, you know, building whatever that learning ecosystem would be for that future.
I think one of the things that you just said, you know, strikes me, the idea that we used to think, let's get an education, let's get into our career, and then we retire. But I think the numbers have been, you know, somebody who's working now probably will have like 10 or 12 jobs throughout their lifetime, and each of those jobs are going to require different skills. So this idea of lifelong learning or long life learning, as you have flipped it on its head a little bit here, what does that mean? What are we going to do? How are we addressing this?
Yeah, so even early baby boomers today who are retiring are on average experiencing approximately 12 job changes by the time they retire. So it's not just the millennials who are switching jobs pretty frequently. It is even the folks who are close to retirement. And so even if you extend the work life of an individual 5, 10, 15 years, we can only extrapolate that, you know, the number of job transitions we might anticipate might reach 20 or 30 over a lifetime. And then as you think about having to do all of those multiple career switches over time, you start to realize, well, how am I actually going to remain competitive in the workforce? How am I going to stay relevant? It's going to require some sort of retooling and reskilling or upskilling over time, but where am I going to actually go to attain that extra learning? And especially with the cost of college and graduate school so high at this point, and the, you know, where we're exceeding, you know, unimaginable limits of student loan debt, it seems hard for us to just sort of say, oh yeah, I'll just go back to college or go back to graduate school in the future. It just seems, it's not the answer here. And so where are we going to go for these more short burst, you know, immersive programs where we can either broaden some of our human skills or access some technical expertise in artificial intelligence or whatever the technology may be that we have to be savvy about. So this is where we really have to start getting a little bit more creative about more seamless on and off ramps in and out of learning and work, and at the same time as work.
This is an issue, and it's something that we've been talking about for a while. But what is the solution? Not everybody can stop work and, you know, be educated. Are business leaders the ones who are going to have to figure out how to upskill their workforce? Is there going to have to be alternative education that's more price friendly?
The onus is on all of the stakeholders involved in our education and workforce ecosystem. So right now, unfortunately, almost all of the burden is on us as individuals and as job seekers to just sort of figure this out on our own and skill up and try to ensure that we are competitive and market ourselves well and can get jobs. And all the financial risk is on us as well. Certainly, there are some employers who offer things like tuition reimbursement programs or tuition assistance programs. But again, it is still hinging on the idea that you as the individual or the job seeker are going to figure out how to do all that on top of your full-time or multiple part-time jobs and your family commitments and your caregiving responsibilities, all of those things. You're going to have to add on that upskilling on your own and figure out how to do that on top of all of that life. So as we think about the future, obviously there are real opportunities for employers to stop retreating from training like they have been over the last few decades and start taking on a little bit more of that onus and thinking about how they take their existing workforce and mold them so that they're more prepared for emerging jobs and jobs of the future. And much of that is going to mean that they have to solve for the most precious resource of all of us, which is time. And most employers, while they are some of those, you know, some of the most forward-thinking employers like Amazon or JP Morgan Chase, who are creating these, you know, $100 million initiatives to upskill workers, we still haven't figured out how to solve for the challenge of time and ensuring that there's time carved out throughout the workday or ways where it's integrated into your existing work where you are learning new skills for the future. So that is really critical. How do we create more experiential, hands-on, work-based learning opportunities for people who are in the workforce so that they either don't have to forego wages in order to advance or try to figure out how to do this on top of everything else going on in their lives? And then learning providers and education providers at the same time do need to figure out how to meet adult learners more where they are. It's kind of fascinating to see in the book, I talk about how basically by mid-2030, there are a lot of projections out there that show that the traditional college-going student population is just going to fall off a cliff. Those 18 to 24-year-old learners, we just don't have enough of them to fill the over 4,300 institutions we have today. And so why at the same time we have this growing population of what we call non-traditional learners, these adult learners, but most universities haven't actually pivoted and shifted their models to attend to those learners in a much more individualized, flexible, and convenient manner. And so there's a real opportunity for institutions to figure out how they serve adult learners better, how they make it so that they're not, again, having to do things that are duplicative of learning experiences that they may have had, or, you know, informal learning that they've gathered along the way through their jobs. How do you take that person who is maybe 47 years old and looking to transition and understand who they are right now with all of their hidden skills and informal learning experiences, and kind of move them more quickly along and advance them more quickly, because most of these folks are struggling to survive, especially in our current pandemic. How do we get them quickly and rapidly into a better economic opportunity? So it's really on all the stakeholders here in this kind of three-legged stool. It cannot always just sit with the job seeker.
You're talking about not enough, you know, traditional younger students to fill the institutes that are out there. Do you see some of the schools going away?
They already are. I mean, I think especially with the pandemic, I mean, even prior to the pandemic, we were seeing a lot of schools merge, struggling, and trying to figure out different sorts of centralized or shared services models, because they were so tuition dependent and the market around them was shifting. You know, I think Moody's has really downgraded the outlook for a lot of universities, and, you know, with many of them potentially seeing, you know, 15% drop in enrollment, they just won't be able to survive. So there's a real potential for just a huge kind of tectonic shift in what our academic landscape looks like today. But at the same time, as some of these universities see the opportunity to serve adult learners better, it's not as though they have to start completely from scratch. There are really interesting new models out there that are these kinds of on-ramps to better economic opportunities. You know, they're short bursts. They're almost taking the model of a coding bootcamp, but positioning learners for careers in healthcare and cybersecurity and advanced manufacturing. It doesn't have to be just about coding. There's even some really interesting skilling up opportunities in the oil and gas industry. So there are ways in which existing innovators and startups and organizations are trying to condense learning into these bite-sized, more manageable and briefer programs that people can take on. And for universities that are struggling, this is the time to start getting creative about partnerships and going to the folks who have already done a lot of the research on the needs and the constraints of these particular learners, because it is a very different kind of population that we're talking about. And even across the adult learner space, you know, we're talking about anyone beyond the age of 24. It's too monolithic to kind of look at the adult learner space that way. So within that huge category, there are different ways in which you need to carve and attend to learners differently, especially as you think about, you know, trying to reintegrate and help with reentry services for people who were formerly incarcerated. Those are a different kind of set of wraparound support services that are needed. So a lot of organizations have been doing this work over the years, and maybe some of them don't have the best business models to sustain. So here's where maybe there are really interesting partnerships to be had between these institutions and some of these upstart innovators.
One of the things that the pandemic exposed was some inequities in the system when it comes to race, when it comes to income. And when you talk about this, you know, long life learning and having to change the model, I think that's part of what we have to address, is how do we make sure these opportunities to upskill, to prepare for careers, are more broadly available?
Yeah, exactly. This book is very much centered on this challenge of equity in our deeply inequitable set of systems that we have. So the crux of this book really is around this, what many people know as curb cut effects, and how if you solve for the pain points of the people who are most at risk or most constrained, you can actually benefit everyone. And one of the helpful ways to enter into these challenges is to look at the people who are not thriving today. And even before the pandemic, we had over 40 million working age adults who were not thriving in the labor market. And of course, that just got way worse once COVID-19 hit. But I think, you know, it's not as though these problems didn't exist. It's just that the pandemic really laid bare all the inadequacies in our infrastructure. And so when we think about all the friction that exists in the system, it's most helpful to follow the learners and the workers who are struggling the most. And so in this book, every chapter in the second half of the book starts with the voices of these people, of the people who are struggling the most. And it takes from their perspective all the kinds of different unique challenges that they're facing. And all I do is basically organize the themes that these interviews coalesce around. And it really comes down to issues of career navigation, wraparound supports, more targeted or more precise educational programs, not always just, you know, a 1, 2, or 4 year program. And then experiences that can be integrated more into the work environment and more fairer and transparent hiring practices. And so you have to first figure out all of these obstacles and solve for these pain points, because if you actually do this right, it's actually going to benefit all of us. And we have to remember that all of us, no matter if we have a degree or a job or an advanced degree, we are all going to be put into this position where we're going to have to retool ourselves in some way to stay relevant in the workforce. And where are we going to go? We need to rely on the same ecosystem that everyone else has been struggling with. If we actually start to create a healthier and better functioning set of systems or an ecosystem where people are actually building and knitting together services and solutions in a more seamless way, we're all going to benefit as we have to navigate those 10, 20, or 30 job transitions in the future. So it's this idea that if we go in with this equity lens and think about folks who are most constrained in this current environment today, who are really struggling to survive, this is going to benefit all of us in the long run.
Are there any of those stories that really stood out to you? Any of the challenges that kind of speak to, you know, like an individual challenge that speaks to what you're saying here? And how are those people, how are they managing it itself? I mean, it kind of goes back to your saying, it's up to us now, but are they getting the help that they need?
It's hard because I feature so many different interviews and they're all so powerful, but some of the most interesting ones were around this challenge of time poverty, where with so many things coming at these learners all at the same time, issues of foreclosure, divorce, challenges in accessing enough work. This, most of them talk about the lack of a mental space to, even though they know that they should go back and pursue some sort of education in order to move forward, they don't have that kind of mental space, or they are in a learning experience, but the entire time they cannot focus because they're thinking about all these issues that are unresolved, or their children, you know, who haven't seen their mother in, you know, 12 hours. One really powerful story was a woman who, because she couldn't figure out how else to integrate her educational experience into her life, she would end up trying to put all her classes on Saturday and would spend 12 hours in classes and would be pumping milk during the day and kind of walking home in between classes to deliver the milk to her baby and going back to classes and just trying to squeeze it all into this one free day that she had. So these real just kind of powerful stories on even with the best intentions to reskill, or even in the midst of acquiring some of that learning, we still haven't solved for how to make this more flexible. And we have to figure out a way to, you know, we always talk about meeting learners where they are, but the stories that that these interviewees shared with us just really underscore how critical it is that we also figure out some of these wraparound support services, or these like 360 degree services that will help a learner persist and be able to focus, you know, small interventions like childcare offerings or a refrigerator, you know, in a resource center for learners to store their pumped milk. These small kinds of interventions sometimes can really open up these working learners to focus and actually advance.
I think that is a very powerful example, and it's probably reflective of a lot of people out there, especially adult learners who are trying to get those skills and education that they need to advance. As we wrap up, I'd love to know, maybe this question is a difficult one, but how far along are we in addressing these issues? And do we think we're going to get there anytime soon?
I think in some ways, because of the pandemic, we are going to ultimately benefit in terms of jumpstarting this work on building this new learning ecosystem. Because it was funny, as I wrote the initial draft of this book for my editor, I turned it in maybe a week before COVID hit the US. And in my mind, I think the work ahead seemed like something that we needed to really start working on now, so that 5 and 10 years out from now, we would be better positioned. But what has happened is that timeline has just become fast forwarded to now, right? That future, all the trending conversations about the future of work suddenly became about the present of work and how, you know, when we saw that millions of workers could not figure out how to think about transferring their skills from one industry to another, it made very clear how inadequate our systems are. We don't have those brief, seamless upskilling programs. We don't have ways to catalog people's skills and talents and assets to help them understand how they transfer them from one domain to another, right? To move from retail into a better opportunity in finance or PR and advertising. We don't have those mechanisms. And some of the ones that we did have were more business-to-business operations. They weren't actually consumer-facing tools and resources. So suddenly you saw in our ecosystem today, scrambling, right? There was all of a sudden, you know, this renewed emphasis on building new coalitions to get this work done. So I think we're going to benefit because there is this real openness and excitement around finally doing something instead of just talking about the problem or admiring the problem. So I feel like there's real opportunity and optimism there. The only challenge is that we are in a very beginning phase of this. We are very good at working in silos and in parallel, whether it's in the for-profit or nonprofit or public sectors. We are not great at playing well together. So it's going to change. It's going to take a changing of mindsets, a different kind of approach to servant leadership and leading from behind and building these coalitions. So there's a lot of work to do, but I think in the grand scheme of things, the great news is that we don't actually need to be constantly dreaming up a future of work. It's now right in front of us that we have to figure out today.
Michelle, it's always great to talk to you, and I really appreciate you taking time out to talk about your new book, Long Life Learning, Preparing for Jobs That Don't Even Exist Yet. I wish you all the luck on it.
Thank you so much, Ramona.
I've been speaking to Michelle Weiss, author of the new book, Long Life Learning, and entrepreneur in residence and senior advisor at Imaginable Futures. I'm Ramona Schindelheim, editor-in-chief of Working Nation. Thank you very much for listening.